We have a real full agenda today, and anything we can't get through today, we will carry over till tomorrow's meeting. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We've got a little space to work with there. So I will start out today by opening a work session for possible measure introduction. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move LC 1961 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Beyer has moved LC 1961 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Okay, now I will open a public hearing. Should we take these in block?
Madam Chair, probably should take them in block because I know there are two members here that were on the work group. I believe one or two more from the work group will be coming here. And it's been a product of an eight-month effort, and they all do relate.
Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 408, consecutive to Senate Bill 415. That's 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 415. So open a public hearing on those measures. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you eight bills, Senate Bill 408 through 415, that come to you from Senator Brown, Senator Cruz, Representative Krieger, Representative Schaffler. This is a product of an interim work group on the area of dependency. Senate Bill 408 prohibits the Department of Human Services from filing a petition to terminate a parent's parental rights to his or her child only if the court has previously approved the permanency plan for the child. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you also the Dash-1 amendments, broadens the scope of the prohibition to clarify the provision applies to other sections of the Dependency Code when termination of parental rights are at risk. And the Dash-2 amendments, which is Section 13 of Senate Bill 282, allows the court to reconsider parental termination order if more than 12 months have elapsed since the child was placed for adoption. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you Senate Bill 409, allows the court to direct the Department of Human Services to place a child with relatives, a person who has a caregiver relationship with a child. You have also the Dash-1 amendments, requires placement with a certified or licensed foster care. This, I believe, comes from DHS. Dash-2 suggestion, substitute Section 8 of 282, allows for placement with parents, relatives, or another foster care provider. Senate Bill 410 sets forth the process and procedure for the Director of Human Services to convene a sensitive review committee for the purpose of reviewing the actions and conduct of the department. Allows the President of the Senate and Speaker of the House to request the Director to convene the sensitive review committee. If the Director appoints a committee, if it requests the Senate President or Speaker, the Speaker shall appoint at least one member from the respective chambers and must make reasonable efforts to assure a balanced committee. The Senate President must do the same. You have the Dash-1 amendments. The bill deletes the term less and substitutes the term more. Senate Bill 411 appropriates additional funds to Public Services Commission for the biennium beginning July 1, 2007 of the General Fund for the purposes of improving legal representation for parents and children in dependency cases. You have the Dash-1 amendments. It clarifies the Public Defense Service Commission can use additional funds for the improving training and other things that will improve the quality of legal representation. Senate Bill 412 requires the Department of Human Services to notify an attorney representing a child in foster care and the court-appointed special advocate for the child when the department receives a report that the child has been abused. We have the Dash-1 amendments. Before it expands the reporting of child abuse to the attorney, a court-appointed special advocate to a child temporarily in custody, DHS, also requires notice of child abuse to the attorney, a court-appointed special advocate, be made within 3 business days of receipt of the complaint. Senate Bill 413 requires the Department of Human Services to submit a report to the appropriate legislative committee with child welfare matters. The report must include the number of children in foster care, the number of children that have been more than one foster care placement, and the number of placements each child with more than one placement has had. The Dash-1 amendments require the report be made to the legislature in even-numbered years on November 1 rather than September 1. Senate Bill 414 requires the Department of Human Services to make reasonable efforts to place siblings together with siblings when siblings are removed from the home and placed in foster care, residential care, or group care unless such placement is not in the best interest of either child. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dash-1 amendments before you, which basically are sections 2 to 7, 9, and 14 from Senate Bill 282, which is basically in considerable more details describes facts and circumstances when this should be done. Madam Chair, finally, you have Senate Bill 414 creates an ombudsman for family and caregivers of children who are subject to the jurisdiction of juvenile court. You have the Dashbone amendments, which move the ombudsman from the...
Correction, Senate Bill 415.
415, I'm sorry. You have the Dash... one amendments in front of you, which move the ombudsman from the governor's to the governor's office from DHS.
Thank you very much. And again, today we have the honor of the presence of Representative Krieger from House Judiciary, who was a member of the work group that developed this legislation. And Representative Krieger and Representative Cruz and Senator Brown, when she comes back, is she coming returning?
Yes, she'll try to get back.
Okay, I'd like to turn the program over to you if you want to go up there. And just give a few introductory remarks about this package. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, many members, for the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Rep District 1 on the South Coast. And I'm not going to discuss today so much the legislation, but maybe the process that got us to where we are, because I think if you understand that, I think it helps quite a bit. We were able to convene a sensitive review committee that had not been done before because Dr. Goldberg had agreed to do so when requested by our staff attorney and worked with us for about, I think it was 8 to 10 months that we were involved in this. The sensitive review committee has Representative Flores, Representative Richardson, Representative Schaffler, Casa, Dr. Goldberg, Ramona Foley, Mickey Cerise, Nancy Miller, and several staff from the Lincoln County. I can't go into the details of what we found because it is sensitive, but I think that process was one that got us to where we could move forward. And what we did find were some things that were quite alarming that were happening in the agency, and then we felt that it was not isolated. It was probably happening throughout the state, and that has proved to be true. My wife's got about 8 of them she's working on now as my legislative aide, and we've been successful with DHS on some of those. The particular case at the time, our staff attorney, Joe O'Leary, took that case, which was 3,500 pages, which would have been horrible for us to try to digest, knocked it down to 310. We had 3 meetings with that group that I mentioned earlier, and out of that, 38 questions arose, and from that, some directions to the DHS to get us the answers. For the most part, they were able to do that. There are still ongoing things that they report back to the work group. As with the meth package, with which two of you here, Senator Beyer and Senator Burdick, you were part of, the thing that made that work is that we had a Republican and a Democrat from every caucus. So we took that concept. Well, I had Representative Schaffler and myself, so we had a DNR in the House, but we did not have that in the Senate. And when I found out that Kate Brown, Senator Kate Brown, actually worked in that field, it seemed obvious she would be the one that could really benefit us, and she really has. And we brought her into the process, and Senator Cruz. I don't know at this time how many meetings we've had, but it seems like we meet just about every week. We met during the interim. Everybody has been dedicated to this. Didn't matter if we had to make a 500-mile round trip to be up here, get it done, and then go home, we did it. And I think that dedication has continued. We're going to continue to meet. We're not going to break up. We're going to work right on through the session and into the interim. What was interesting about it, when we were doing the sensitive review committee, I happened to be in the basement and talking to people down there at the cafe, and Judge Brewer came in. And in our conversation, he asked me what I was doing. I explained what we were doing. And he said, well, I'm investigating or doing an appeals on a case in Lincoln City. And I said, whoa, we can't talk. I bet we're talking about the same case. Well, guess what? We were. And he put that case back to DHS. After he had done that, I asked Joe O'Leary to talk to him if it would be improper for him to talk to us about that case that had been adjudicated. He said, no, that portion which is public we could talk about. And we spent about an hour and a half talking about the judicial side of the problem and what he saw over there and what we maybe could glean out of our investigations as to what he may not be aware of. That ended up being a meeting with Chief Justice Paul Domenez and some his staff people. And out of that came another work group that's dealing with the court process, the frozen record, appeals issues, and others, which is still going on. And it's been gratifying at the time we had You know, you had the judicial system, which was communicating with the legislative branch like we never have on an issue before. We have the House, we have the Senate, and for the most part, we have leadership that understands where we're going. We have the agency on board with all these things. The outcome of that are the eight bills that you see there, proposed administrative rule changes that the department, DHS, is going to implement, policy changes within the agency, better and advanced training for caseworkers, better training for the attorneys that work in this field, and the bar is working on that, increased compensation suggestions for these attorneys, because you can't, you know, your plumber costs you $65 or $70 an hour, and we're having an attorney do this work for $40 an hour, and that's why the representation is not equal to what you see on the other side. I think we also have to try to deal with the fact that oftentimes the caseworkers are really acting as attorneys and are not represented when they should be before the court, so we're dealing with that issue. And also better representation for the parents and the children. Everybody has been dedicated to this process, and up to this time, I have not heard of any issue that has come to the forefront that may stop this, and it's been gratifying to see everybody. You're going to see parents, you're going to hear testimony, and I think for the most part you're going to find out that we want to make children safe, fix the process a little bit, and there will be unanticipated things that we didn't think about, just like there was with the meth package, but we can address that later. Thank you.
Thank you. I might just point out for the record that only one member of that work group had to travel 500 miles to get to meetings. So thank you very much for your service, Representative Krieger. Welcome, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, State Senator, Senate District 1, and I do not travel as far as Wayne, but he could have always stopped and picked me up and never did. I wish the other two members of our work group were here with us at this moment, because I had a great opening line, because it would be Senator Brown and Representative Schaffer, and I'd say this would be a great beginning for a poker hand, a queen, and three jokers, but I guess I can't use that now. So, Representative Krieger and Mr. Taylor pretty much laid out most of the details of it, and we will have testimony. I guess the thing that strikes me is in my decade here in the building, some of the most significant work that I have been involved in has kind of gone through this process, and so this, like several other things that we have done, will probably not get much attention from the media because it's not controversial. Everybody's in agreement, which I find very curious. And I guess I want to give kudos to the folks other than our work group that have given us great input and insight, including the department and Dr. Goldberg and Nikki Cerise is back here. He's been incredibly helpful, and Ramona Foley, who I think was one of the best hires the Department of Human Services ever made in the state of Oregon. She's she brought a real breath of fresh air to that department. But it's interesting how everything's lined up. We had a presentation, 6 weeks ago from Hardy Myers on the work that they are doing, and some packages they are bringing forward this session to make some clear, bright lines between responsibilities and authorities of the DA's office and the AAGs, and some oversight that they're proposing, which fit in very, very well with the direction we are attempting to go. Juvenile Rights Project, obviously, it seemed to be, although working in a separate universe, seemed to be very parallel to the stuff we were doing. And in fact, when I went over their bill with them, I think first week of session, they came in to see me, and I took the meeting with a mild amount of trepidation, being the heartless, cold Republican that I am, and found that where their bill in some of the substantive pieces differ from ours, their language was better, and so you know, it has just been an incredibly collaborative process, and we've actually kind of been amazed at the at how everything has coalesced together to create a package that doesn't necessarily solve all the problems, but I think tremendously improves the system, both with the bills that you see before you today, the bills from the Justice Department that will be appearing downstairs in Ways and Means, and the work of the department. And I want to state that again, that the work the department is doing internally to correct some of these things is going to go a long way towards helping. Our goal when we started out, quite simply, was to make sure that we put some teeth and some motion behind the concept that we've had around here forever, that the first and number one priority is best interest of the child. And we think this goes a long way towards making sure that that is always the predominant number one goal of any actions, is to make sure it's in the best interest of the child. I guess the timing of this is also relatively important as we look at the expansion that we are having of caseloads going into the system. And, you know, Representative Krieger talked about the meth package last time. We will start seeing some repercussions of that, probably escalating. But also that speaks to the fact that a lot of the kids that are entering the system are very high needs kids, where before maybe they weren't, but meth-affected babies are clearly different from as far as the psychological impacts and the physiological impacts. So our ability to deal with these kids and place them appropriately is incredibly huge. Senator Beyer also had a bill dealing with relative foster care that is going to be included in the package. It's a very good concept, and I support that. Out of this whole list of bills, there may be two that I think we'd be comfortable seeing move today. The rest of them, we want to make sure that the nexus between these and other bills are appropriate, and we aren't leaving any strings dangling as we move it through. We want to make sure that we have as complete and finished a package as we have before it leaves this chamber. So I want to thank you for hearing these. This is a significant piece of work for this legislative assembly, and I'm glad to be bringing it before you.
Thank you very much. It is an awesome piece of work, and I really appreciate you for all the incredible efforts the four of you made. Are there questions from the committee?
Good thing we don't have any answers. So.
You can rejoin the panel, and as far as your point about certain bills might be ready to move along, I'll just look for your guidance on that. Okay, we have signed up without specifying which bill. We have signed up two residents of Ada County, Idaho, from Boise, Lois DeRose and Julia Snitter. We don't get too many people from Boise here, so welcome to the committee. You definitely fulfill the 100-mile or more rule. Welcome.
Well, we'll do the best we can. This is a first for us.
So you have to give your name for the record.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Julia Suter. My address is 727 Tower Lane, Caldwell, Idaho, 83607. And I've traveled from Idaho today to speak to you about Senate Bills 408 through 415 and how I support these and how I definitely applaud everyone who's worked so very hard on these. I suppose in our situation, had these been sooner, they might have been of great assistance to us. I'm a wife. I'm a mother. I'm a registered nurse. I'm a caregiver to my family, the patients that I serve. I'm here today to talk to you about my nephew, Skylar DeRoost, whom we found out about, I guess is the easiest way to put that, in November of 06. We got an email from an aunt in Oregon stating that there's this girl looking for us and there's this baby, and we're going, wait a minute, how is this baby possible? The baby's father was in OYA's care and was released early. His victims were not notified, therefore we had no idea. At that point, the mother gave us the caseworker's number. We called her, and we had a family meeting and said, you know, we want to be a resource for this child. We are his family. And at that point, all the doors got shut. We were told that, yes, this paperwork will be sent to you. We did call back and verify, you know, was the paperwork sent? 2 weeks later, we'd never gotten the resource paperwork from Oregon. And we had went forward and wrote a formal letter of our intent, which is in your packets. Also, I placed a call to a contact that I have within DHS, and I said, you know, I'm really concerned about my nephew. I'm not getting any communication, and everybody knows me. I'm a communicator. And I gave her the information that I had, which is very limited. And she called me back. And she says, you need to write letters today. These are the people that you need to write letters to. Ramona Foley, the governor's advocacy office, to all the supervisors. She says, because they have no intention of sending you the paperwork. They have no intention of letting you see him or have him. At that point, I was very concerned, but it's like, what's going on, you know?
If I could just break in for a half second. We've
absolutely.
Got quite a few people signed up, and this is a very thick packet. So
right.
Anything you can do to keep...
Basically, I'm just kind of going... It's an outline of all of that. And
okay,
in that,
and we have that. We have the outline in front mm-hmm. of us, so if you could kind of condense that would be very helpful.
Absolutely. Some of the things that became immediate concern to me are Oregon Administrative Rule oversights. In your packet, I have addressed those for you very specifically. Families are supposed to be the placement of choice in Oregon. We have not even been given that opportunity. The administrative rules state that there should be a diligent search for family. No one ever tried to find us. We've been told to come to as a consensus as a family, which we have done. My mother lives with me. Idaho Interstate Compact has never been notified once our paperwork finally got turned in, which we eventually received after 3 weeks. So that's held up our process on our side to facilitate us becoming a resource for him. Ultimately, we requested for 2 months visitation. That's all been denied as of February 5th because it's not in his best interest. No definition of what in his best interest is. I have a hard time believing that in his best interest to see his grandmother, his aunt, his uncle, his cousins. I can't believe that that's bad for him. I've worked very hard to work with DHS. I really urge you to pass these as quickly as possible to prevent families from having to go through what we've had to go through.
Thank you. And you believe, having looked at these bills, that had these been in place, that your situation would have been dealt with very differently and you would currently
absolutely.
Be able
absolutely.
To see your nephew?
My name is Jean Jerust, and I am Skylar's grandmother. I have worked diligently for over 30 years in the state of Oregon for children in just about every capacity you can think of, from foster parent to adoptive parent to starting CASA, you name it, I've done it, to getting the Points of Light Award from the President of the United States. So to be denied just to visit my grandson is beyond anything. And as we started this, I tried really hard to convince my children, wait a minute, Oregon has very strong administrative rules in place that should address us and allow us this access. I could have excused maybe they're not finding me, but not quite. I'm pretty easy to find. I'm pretty out there, okay? And, I mean, my most recent foster child left the home a year and a half ago. I decided at that time I would retire. That girl and most of my children graduate with honors and go on to college and have a future. So I worked very diligently for Oregon, and for Oregon, not in turn, to support me in my time of need over a grandchild. I just couldn't fathom it. It is beyond anything I can understand. I believe very firmly that these bills will give us parents, grandparents, the rights to move forward and have some form of legal communication that we can address, because right now as we speak, our attorney is trying to address them for us, but she has been blocked at every turn. We never wanted to get into this conflict. We just want to make sure that Skylar is cared for, that he is loved. And to be honest with you, as much as I've loved the children of Oregon, I can't see where my loving my grandson is not in his best interest, why I can't see him, why I can't hold him, why I can't simply count his fingers, count his toes, look into his eyes and see what color they are. This is beyond anything I can comprehend. I believe very firmly that if these bills are passed, it will give us a start. But there's more to be done. But this is a very, very good start, and it's very encouraging for me as I arrived here to read these bills and to think that maybe, just maybe, I have a chance of seeing my grandson.
Well, thank you for coming. You live in Boise, and you have foster children from Oregon?
No. I stayed in Oregon. We stayed in Oregon as a family until that last child graduated from high school. We did that deliberately for that child because I wanted to be in Oregon in Idaho. Once my husband passed, I wanted to go to Idaho and go to school. And this was my opportunity after all of these years of service to do something for me.
Oh, good for you. Thank you. It sounds like you were a very successful foster parent. And thank you for coming to testify on this.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Byer?
Yes. And I don't think the question is for these witnesses, but maybe for Mr. Taylor or one of the work group members. But do these bills do they work retroactively so that if we'd have passed them, and is the design then that families like this can start taking advantage of the law as it is then, or is it only from a prospective?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that would be the law. My assumption is it would apply to future hearings. I'm trying to watch the back wall of the people that work for the Department of Justice and other places. I think it would be problematic if you had something that was settled and then to go back and reopen it. I think both from a policy viewpoint and from a legal viewpoint. But I frankly, to their case, I don't know where it stands. I mean, you'd have to know the facts of the particular case. I don't know whether the child has been put up for adoption and has been adopted. If the child has been adopted and all the processes and procedures are done correctly, I don't see how you could undo that.
He's not been adopted.
But if it's still an ongoing active case, then my sense is yes, this would count on ongoing active cases. It's not like, you know, it would take effect.
Representative Krieger.
DHS, Madam Chair, has been involved in this, and they know these bills probably better than we do. And they know the intent of the work group. I cannot imagine them avoiding the intent for any particular reason. Might have just a question of the ladies. When did you contact my office? Do you know when it was regarding your situation?
It was last Thursday. Resultant of an Oregonian article I found Thursday night.
This is not uncommon, Madam Chair. We've got, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10 in the pipeline as a result of the Sensitive Review Committee and the Oregonian, and word gets spread. So over the weekend, my wife spent 4 or 5 hours on Sunday working on those cases. We'll continue to do that until we get to them. And DHS is being communicated with regarding this now through my office. I would expect if they continue to respond as they have, that perhaps we can get to the thing what I call justice and right. That should prevail. And they know very well, Mr. Cerise does, my desire for him and his agency to continue to work with these people. And if there is something, when they do a review of one of these cases that was inappropriate, we expect them to fix it. I think this committee would expect them to fix it. This building would want them to fix it. There was a mindset change with five different directors and lack of leadership there for many years. And with Dr. Goldberg there and Ramona, the work group, there's a really desire to go back and take a look at it. Many of these that we find, if we find something wrong, fix it. The majority of them, things were right. But when something is wrong, I think you're going to find them very much in agreement that they want to make sure justice is done.
Thank you, Representative Krieger, and that's an important statement in terms of legislative intent. So I appreciate you getting that on the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for the packets. Okay, we have Patrick Dowd and... We've got all these.
Maybe want to bring Ingrid Swenson.
Angela Sherbo and Ingrid Swenson. Is Judge Brownhill here as well?
She is.
Can we pull up another chair? You guys were all kind of bracketed here. I can't tell what.
Could we add Sybil Bear and they make it five? Madam Chair?
That would be absolutely wonderful. If you would just, there are three mics and five people, so just make sure you got a mic sticking in your face when you talk and should work out just fine. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Maybe I'll begin. Madam Chair, Ingrid Swenson, members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson with the Office of Public Defense Services, and you've already called all of the other witnesses today. I think all of us are here on Senate Bill 411. I do want to say that at least Angela Sherbo and I were some small part of the interim work that has been going on with this work group, and it's been a remarkable thing to observe how this group of legislators has been so utterly committed to making some major improvements in the way this system works for children and families. I have been a small part of it. We've attended meetings occasionally with the members, provided information if we were asked to do so, and throughout that process have just found it quite remarkable to see it underway. Senate Bill 411 addresses one piece of the problem, or attempts to address one piece of the problem, and that is the quality of representation which is provided to parents and children in this system. And the two work groups of the juvenile dependency, the two subcommittees of that group, related to quality of representation and what could be done to improve that quality. The second subcommittee related to what kinds of outcomes could we expect to see in the system as a whole if we were successful in improving the quality of representation. Angela chaired one of those subcommittees, and I served on the other. Peter Ozan, who's no longer with our department, chaired that subcommittee. And there's a written report from that. We won't take a great deal of time to talk about those today. I wanted to very briefly tell you about some of the efforts that had been made by the Office of Public Defense Services and the Public Defense Services Commission to address some of these issues. I think you're entitled to know that we were aware, pardon me, that there were concerns. There have been concerns expressed about the quality of representation statewide since at least the 1996, 2000, 2001 bar reports, task force reports on representation. In addition, the Juvenile Court Improvement Project of the Oregon Judicial Department also in 2003 and 2004 noted some of the significant problems, pardon me, with the quality of representation being provided in this area. The Public Defense Services Commission, which most of you know, assumed responsibility for the public defense system in Oregon in 2003. And it initiated a number of processes in 2004 to look at quality in general with respect to representation, but certainly with respect to representation in juvenile cases as well. Among other things, it formed a quality assurance task force, which oversees a process by which the commission intends to evaluate every single public defense provider in the state. We've gotten around to a good many of those to date. Approximately 54% of the caseload is represented by the firms that we have been able to evaluate. We have also undertaken some other efforts. We have a complaint policy which allows people, parents in dependency cases or children or district attorneys or judges or anyone who has a concern about the quality of representation they have observed to bring that to our attention and have it investigated. We've also increased the qualification standards for lawyers who handle these cases, requiring additional training and additional experience in order to take on the representation of dependency clients. We've also worked with a number of organizations, the Oregon State Bar, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Juvenile Rights Project, the University of Oregon, to provide additional training for lawyers. And one of the things that we created was what we call the Juvenile Training Academy. It has so far produced two training programs for lawyers in this area, and with the specific purpose of raising the quality of representation in those cases. But despite those efforts, it's clear that there are still some significant problems, and our site visits have confirmed that in the places where we have conducted them. And among the most important that we found was that there has been a failure on the part of dependency lawyers in many instances to communicate with clients upon appointment. That's their obligation. As soon as they're appointed in the case, they are required to communicate with that client. They are failing to do that in some cases. Lawyers fail to attend or adequately prepare for the initial hearing. That's the hearing at which a child may be removed and which sets the tone for the entire case. Parents and children are often not represented at those hearings. Our lawyers sometimes fail to zealously represent the interests of clients in those hearings, even when they are present, sometimes fail to prepare and argue motions having the potential to advance the client's interests, to conduct adequate investigations, including home visits and psychological evaluations, and to familiarize themselves with relevant treatment and rehabilitation programs that could help their clients overcome the obstacles to reunification. The Commission, the Public Defense Services Commission, has concluded that basically after years of insufficient funding for this area of representation, it is very difficult to identify qualified lawyers to do this work and to retain those lawyers who are qualified and knowledgeable and dedicated in this line of work because of two things. One is the level of compensation, which is simply inadequate, and the second is the heavy caseloads. Lawyers who take on these cases in order to make a living have to take more cases than they should, and that increases their caseload to the point where they cannot competently represent all of those clients. Let me just conclude by quoting from one of the reports which was provided after a site visit. This was by a judge who was talking about one of the best providers in the area, one of the lawyers who was reputed to do the best work. And this judge said, nevertheless, that the attorneys in that office are overtaxed. They are often double and triple booked. Often they have not met their clients before court. They sometimes fail to appear for pretrial conferences or come unprepared. People with caseloads of 200 cases cannot be doing a good job. They don't attend the necessary meetings and aren't there to advocate at critical times. So those are some of the problems. Angela can talk about a number of things in terms of the subcommittees that we have been working on and her own experience at the Juvenile Rights Project. Mr. Dowd has come from Washington State He works with the Office of Public Defense in Washington, and this state has recently had a very successful effort to improve the quality of representation of parents in that state. I'd like you to hear from him about that. Judge Brownhill from Clatsop County is here to talk about some of the issues in her county, and Sybil Bear is an attorney who practiced in Multnomah County for a significant number of years in juvenile court. She was held up as a model by judges and others about the quality of representation she provided. She has recently left that practice, and she can tell you why she did that.
Welcome. Who would like to go next, Angela?
Apparently I am. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Angela Sherbo. I was here before you yesterday. I am one of the two supervising attorneys at the Juvenile Rights Project. I have practiced juvenile law representing parents, children, and foster parents for almost 30 years, 25 of them here in Oregon and 5 before that in Kentucky. I've represented families in juvenile court, in the state appellate courts, including two of my cases that establish the right to counsel for parents, and a case in the Oregon Supreme Court that establishes the fact that that representation must be adequate. I represented families in federal court and before you. I was asked during the interim to participate in the work group on dependency counsel, and I'm very grateful for whomever of you was responsible for that, because it fulfilled something that I feel so strongly about, and those of you who know me know that. We cannot have a higher obligation, those of us who practice law, than to zealously advocate for those who really and truly cannot speak for themselves. And by that I mean some children who literally cannot speak, all the way up through the young and older parents who are caught up in this system. So I was pleased to participate. At the same time, I participated in a work group chaired by the Attorney General's Office with respect to representation for the agency. And so we are hoping to have kind of a really holistic approach to the process. The Quality Assurance Subcommittee that I was asked to chair basically started out with the proposition that we had room for improvement, substantial improvement, that we might be given some additional resources, we didn't know how many, what would be the most cost-effective, beneficial way to spend resources. And it was clear from the beginning that nobody on that group thought that simply raising the pay was sufficient, that we had to address the quality in terms of training, in terms of support, in terms of standards and holding people to standards, that we had to address the caseload sizes, and that we had to, in fact, address compensation. So in my testimony, you have a one-page attachment, which is the final recommendations of the Quality Assurance Subcommittee, and we've identified the weaknesses and essentially made recommendations for a backup center or a resource center to provide that kind of support around the state, enforce performance standards, enforce case limits, and increase compensation. And I want to talk about a couple of those things pretty briefly. I want to try to let you know just how difficult the practice of juvenile law is. It has been treated as is somewhat the stepchild of family law, which is treated as the stepchild of real law, if you will. My children, when they were younger, used to say to me, well, and my husband's also a public defender, if you guys were real lawyers, meaning lawyers who made the kind of money that their friends whose parents were lawyers were, we could have televisions in our room. And our response was, we are real lawyers, and even if we made four times as much money, you couldn't have a television in your room. But there is that clear sense among the bar, among lay people, and some members of the bench that this is sort of the least, not necessarily least important, but least difficult. It is phenomenally difficult. As I say, I've practiced for 30 years. We hold case meetings in our office twice a week. Tuesdays and Wednesdays, lawyers are required to come at lunch to staff cases. Friday mornings, we staff cases with our newer lawyers, and I will tell you that at least once a week, someone asks me a question I don't know the answer to. It's hard. It requires, it's the confluence of family law, juvenile law, probate law, criminal law, federal entitlement law. You have to understand Medicaid. You have to understand the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Interstate Compact on the Placement of Children, the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act. Every one of these cases that involve multiple parties with incredibly high stakes and a ton of emotion also involve complicated interactions of state and federal law, and people out there practicing it, many of them are not doing a good enough job. So that's in terms of how difficult it is. Now, add to that caseload sizes. I did a run before I came here on our lawyers' caseload sizes. It's somewhat difficult in our data system to know exactly how many clients any one lawyer has because we count them by cases, and oftentimes when we're representing children, they're groups of siblings. But two of our more experienced lawyers have in excess of 130 clients that they're responsible for at any given time. A young lawyer with 1 year of experience, we actually counted her cases. She has 92 open cases and 126 individual clients to whom she owes a duty of zealous advocacy. Yesterday you heard from the DHS worker who had 17 open cases and 31 clients. My young lawyer, who makes $36,000, has 92 open cases and 126 individual people, most of them under 18, who rely on her to make sure that their rights are protected. And when I'm talking about the rights being protected, those kids may be relying on her not to be moved across the country or to be moved across the country, to be returned home or not to be returned home, to be with their brothers and sisters or not to be with their brothers and sisters. So it's serious business. It's a difficult business. I mentioned, actually, in addition to running the numbers this morning, I called a number of lawyers who have left my firm and left other firms and asked for their permission, without naming their names, to talk to you about the circumstances and why they left. And they were all extremely gracious. Many of them said, oh, yeah, go ahead and say my name. Our own office lost very recently two exceptionally well-qualified young men, one of whom had to leave because his obligations to his family, to his young children, were such that financially he couldn't make it with us, and the other of whom had to leave because his obligations to his parents and their medical needs were such that he couldn't make it in our office. And both of them authorized me to tell you that story. Ms. Baer will tell you her own story, but I spoke earlier in the day with one of her colleagues at Multnomah Defenders who also left the practice, and she authorized me to tell you that she left because the work was simply too difficult. She couldn't continue to donate the amount of time, weekends, nights, and early mornings that she was donating to the work and taking it away from her child. She told me that when he was about six, she asked him whether he intended to be a lawyer when he grew up, and he said, oh, no, you work way too hard. And that really struck her. Let me see if there's anything else. I guess the one other thing I wanted to say is that there's a tremendous ripple effect to having too many cases. So when Ms. Swenson read you that remark from a judge about good lawyers who didn't have enough time to make it to the hearings they were obligated to attend, what that means is all the other lawyers and all the other parties who did make it to that hearing have to go home. And then we have to do it again. So we wasted their overload, has wasted all of our time and overloaded all of us. And it's a system that's about to collapse. I sometimes say the only reason that I haven't left is that I lack the imagination to do anything else. I think I'll stay. But I'm very lucky. I went to law school long before there were student loans. My husband went to law school on the GI Bill. We don't have televisions in our children's rooms, and we love doing this work. And the young woman that I spoke to who I wanted to present her situation also loves doing this work. But she clears $2,200 a month. She owes a third of that on her law school education. I hope she continues to love enough to stay after she has children.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Krieger.
Chair, maybe no question, but in our work group, it became evident early on that compensation for the attorneys, adequate compensation, was going to be key in this issue. And I had Judge Brewer come in and talk to then Speaker of the House, Menace, along with Joe O'Leary, and he very eloquently talked about equal and adequate representation and how that benefited him in his appeals process and the type of product that he had to deal with. And in our conversations, it became obvious also with good attorneys that had the time and had the caseloads that they could handle, a lot of the issues that were coming up before DHS probably would have been caught by that attorney early in the process and could have avoided a lot of the appeals things that we saw and the feelings that these people. And almost every one of these people that we talked to in these cases that my wife and I are working on, the attorney has not saw those people till in the hallway just before they walked into the court. That is not adequate. That isn't justice. And I think this is one of the key things we have to address, regardless of what the cost is. If we do nothing but this, it will improve the process.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. Who's next?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Dowd, and I'm with the Washington State Office of Public Defense. Traditionally, funding for trial-level defense, both in the criminal arena and in pence representation and dependencies, the cost of that representation has been borne by the individual counties. The Washington State Office of Public Defense was charged with administering the defense representation at the appellate level. In 1999, the legislature directed the Office of Public Defense to look at the issue of parents' representation in dependency matters and termination of parental rights proceedings and report back to the legislature. The findings are not unique to Washington State, and you basically heard from Ms. Sherbaugh and Ms. Swenson the same types of issues that were identified in the report. Counties were struggling. They lacked the resources to adequately fund representation for parents. Because of that, caseloads were exorbitantly high. Attorneys would be meeting clients outside of court for 5 minutes before going into court and attempting to represent the parent in those proceedings. I spoke with one attorney who his caseload was so high he kept his cases in banker's box in the trunk of his car because he was not able to keep up with the court calendar. And this is actually an attorney that was very dedicated to his clients, but his caseload was such that he could not keep up. When compared to funding for parents representation with the amount of funding that was provided to the state agency, it was basically half of the Attorney General's budget for representing the department. There was an equal disparity between case support services that were available.
Okay.
For example, the state Attorney General's budget allocated funds specifically for expert witnesses, expert services to assist in these cases, and there was no similar support services available for parent representation attorneys. There was also a lack of any professional standards throughout the state or qualifications for attorneys. There was no training that was designed and dedicated specifically for parents' attorneys either. At the same time that this study was going on, the state was also responding to increased demands on the system placed by federal legislation aimed at shortening the period of time children were placed in out-of-home care and establishing permanency. And there were great efforts, successful efforts, made by the system in addressing that issue in one sense, in that they were able to increase adoptions. Interestingly, reunification rates continued to decline. So it was apparent that there were not the similar efforts being made towards preserving families. Because of because of parent representation was underfunded, it also not only had an adverse impact, obviously, on the clients, on the parents that were being represented, but it had an adverse impact on the system as a whole. Attorneys were overbooked. They were not available for court hearings. Termination trials were being continued and continued again because those attorneys were backed up in other trials, and it was slowing down the system as a whole. Based on that report, the legislature funded the Washington State Office of Public Defense in 2000 to establish two pilot projects, one in a more urban county in Pierce County, where Tacoma is located, and Benton Franklin County, a more rural area in eastern Washington. The legislature established five program goals. One was to reduce the number of continuances based on attorney unavailability, set maximum caseloads. Caseloads were originally set at 90 cases. They were later reduced to 80 cases, and a case is defined as one parent representation, regardless of the number of children that are involved in the proceeding. Enhanced defense standards, and the real focus was placed on client communication and emphasizing the role of the counselor at law, not just the attorney, the zealous advocate, the litigator, but significant emphasis was placed on the counselor at law and the duty to communicate effectively with your client. There were also provisions made for support services, social workers that could be utilized, and investigators that could be utilized by the parents' attorney, and also it was required that the office provide some oversight as far as screening for indigency that the counties were undertaking. There were several reports done during the life of the pilot projects in 2003 and in 2005. Those reports are available on our website, which are cited on the written material that I provided. And I won't go through every one of these sections in the interest of time, but overall, the program established that they significantly increased reunification. They also decreased the incidence of families reentering the system after reunification has occurred. So the reunifications were, in simple terms, they were sticking, they were working. These weren't families that were just cycling back through the child welfare system. Court continuances were reduced based on caused by attorney unavailability. And then one of the surveys also conducted stakeholder interviews, and they noted just various types of improvements. The whole system became more professional. Judges remarked that, yes, this did lead to an increase in contested hearings, but they were hearings that needed to be brought to the court's attention, and they were being brought to the court's attention in a timely manner, rather than just wait for the next six-month review and then bring up the point that referrals for services haven't been made or there were transportation issues with visitation. These issues were being identified and raised early on in the proceedings. I also wanted to note that because the attorneys had lower caseloads, they were also able to support other systemic improvements that were going on that also lead to better outcomes for children and families. For example, when courts wanted to implement a drug court program, we had the attorney resources to support that. In Spokane County, they've just implemented a program where the court commissioners will rotate through for 1 week and will be assigned to a team of caseworkers, a team of defense attorneys, a team of CASAs, and that team will track the families that come into the system during that court period through the life of the case. So it assures that there's judicial continuity, there's greater access to the court for contested matters, And that's for contested matters. And that's a program that they would not have been able to implement had it not been for the increased number of parent representation attorney resources that were available in Spokane County. Based on the success of the pilot projects, the legislature in the 2005-2007 biennium and then in the 2006 supplemental session allocated $5.3 million to further expand the program. At this point, the program is established in a little less than half of the state. During this legislative session, we're aggressively pushing for full funding to establish the program throughout the state. The program model is such that we will contract with private attorneys, with private firms, with public defender agencies that exist in the counties. Our compensation level for a full-time attorney is $100,000 to $120,000. That sounds like a lot, and frankly...
Relatively speaking, it is.
it is. But that should not be interpreted
as... Wait, Senator Walker has a question.
Is that for one attorney?
Excuse me?
Is that for one attorney?
That is for one attorney, but that is not attorney salary. That's
okay.
For a full-time attorney that is doing these cases, by their contract, they're precluded from doing family law cases, criminal law cases, other private cases on the side. We expect our full-time attorneys to devote 100% of their professional work hours to representing parents in these proceedings. They're required to maintain office space that's accessible to their clients. They're required to have office staff so that when they're not available directly, that a client's calls is not going to a phone system, but they're getting personal attention. And frankly, in some areas we've struggled to contract with attorneys under this system because they realize that they can have a much more lucrative practice outside of our contract. Our model also provides for social work services, and we contract with one social worker for every four full-time attorney positions. Those social workers are able to do independent, for example, relative home studies or observe parent-child visits and report to the court. They're also able to assist the parents engage in services and kind of address the dynamic that can occur, but just the animosity that might develop between a parent and the agency caseworker who, on one hand, is trying to work with the family and provide services, but at the same time is the entity that has removed the child from the parent's care. We also provide a nominal amount of funding for expert services. So if an attorney feels that they need to get an independent psychological evaluation or parenting evaluation for a parent, our office has some level of funding for that. We also provide statewide training to our attorneys, and we're in the process in some of our larger counties of establishing a resource attorney position who can act as a informal mentor for less experienced attorneys, conduct case reviews, provide case strategies and legal advice, and also act as a liaison between our program attorneys and other entities within the child welfare system, such as the court, CASA programs, etc.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, and you may have said this is the statewide training mandatory for your contractors?
It is.
Okay, and can you give me a sense of how many continuing education credits it is?
Well, we
I don't know how you do.
Yeah, we had recently in December we had a day and a half training, and that we received 11 CLE credits through the State Bar Association. The training is mandatory per contract. We also try to do regional trainings when we can, and frankly, that's I think will be more effective as the program has grown to the size that it is now to. Try to do more regional trainings and less statewide trainings. The practice standards are set out in the written material. In the interest of time, I won't go through each one of those. But again, the overall focus is to communicate effectively with the client, establish a relationship of trust, litigate issues that need to be litigated, and identify barriers that the parent is facing in addressing parental deficiencies and engaging in services and overcoming those barriers. I indicated that we're requesting full funding to...
I do have a question for you. Mr. Dowd, I have in front of me the National Council on Juvenile and Family Law Court Judges report in your system, and it says I understand the average number of days spent in foster care decreased from 290 to 235 days. Is that correct? That's the result of that study?
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
And also that the reunification increased from 36% to 56%?
That's right.
And also that terminations were reduced from 43% to 22%?
That's correct. I think it also indicates that there was an increase also in negotiated open adoptions, basically, where an attorney would work with the department under certain circumstances where a parent recognized that the best interest of the child would be to establish an adoption, but there'd be an open adoption agreement or contract entered to allow for ongoing contact between the biological parents and the child.
So, Mr. Dowd, do you know how much that saved the state of Washington as far as foster care expenses and other expenses associated with parental termination?
I don't, but I can certainly try to pursue that information and report back to you.
It's fair to say it saved them a considerable amount of money, though.
Certainly.
Thanks.
And it would also be fair to say that it saved more money than it costs to make the investment, or do you know that?
I would like to say that I'd like to confirm that. Mm-hmm. I don't have those numbers, so I...
We'll look forward to getting that. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krieger.
You know, we're talking about dollars, but I'm not certain how you measure the investment into the child of family being back together, being raised in a functional family again when they get the services they need. We dealt with the same thing in Oregon with our meth package. We didn't know the $11 million we put in the meth package, what that would get back. One report was $128 million in savings over the biennium. It's hard to measure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for pointing that out. Okay.
One last comment. There have been a number, within the last year, there have been a number of cases out of the Washington State Court of Appeals, and none of them have been from our trial-level program attorneys, but in which trial court decisions terminating parental rights were reversed and remanded based on findings of ineffective assistance of counsel. Mm-hmm. And I think those cases really demonstrate, number one, just the harm that it causes the child, the parent, the prospective foster parents, or adoptive parents, when that happens. When it goes through the Court of Appeals process for perhaps 2 years, and then we're back at square one. And frankly, the parents, the consequences of these cases are just so extremely significant that there's an obligation to provide effective representation in these matters. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions from the panel? Senator Krasinski.
Yeah, I just want to follow back up on when you're going through the program model. There are some eyebrows, as I say, were raised when you talked about how much the contract attorneys are making, $100,000, $120,000. Could you give us a perspective as to your circuit court or our general jurisdiction judges, trial judges, what type of salary they have that they receive?
I'm sorry, my hearing's not too good.
I'm wondering if you could tell us what type of salary range the judges in Washington State receive from sitting on the bench that have general jurisdiction, your trial judges?
I think their salary is in the range of $120,000.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I point out that compensation is for overhead.
Right.
Everything.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the parts. Is I know that we're not looking at doing that, but you have to take the scale of what's being bought and what's being required to be paid for. And clearly, I know that moving people up from $40 an hour to whatever it may turn out to be is going to be much will be quite less than what we see here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we were the office was trying to establish some level of parity with the attorneys that were representing the Division of Children and Family Services for the state. And so that's, I think that was kind of the motivation.
Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We got an average of 55 days reduction in foster care per case. Can you give me an idea of how many cases in this? You know, not the whole state yet in Washington, but do you have any kind of a figure on how many cases were covered
in the pilot project? I know that I think there are roughly 10,000 children in state care in Washington State, and I don't know how many children were included in the. In the pilot projects or studies.
Marimba band over there. Okay, any other questions? Senator Brown.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, you may have addressed this well, and I wasn't able to get here till just a few minutes ago. Could you talk, do you have DAs and Assistant Attorney Generals representing both the state and the agency in these cases, or is it pretty straightforward, your AAGs, your Assistant Attorney Generals, represent the agency throughout the entire life of the case? Could you just briefly talk about that for a moment?
Right. The Assistant Attorney Generals represent the department through kind of every phase of the proceeding, dependency through termination and on appeal. There are, I think, one or two counties where, smaller counties where the Attorney General's office contracts with a local attorney who acts as a special assistant attorney general, but that's the rare situation.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. So the Attorney General's office is representing the department throughout the entire life of the case in Washington?
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. We're running out of time, so if you can, the last two people, there a lot of information has been presented. If you can avoid repetition, that would be great.
I'll do my best. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Sybil Baer. I'm an attorney with Cartwright & Associates in Portland. I had been doing court-appointed work since 1992 and exclusively doing dependency and termination of parental rights cases with an emphasis on parents since 1994. I spent about 8 months at Juvenile Rights Project, and after that I was with Multnomah Defenders until about October of 06. My preference was in representing parents. I did review the recommendations and the findings of Senate Bill 411, and I completely agree with everything that's stated within that proposal. I don't think that you can emphasize enough how important it is to have experienced attorneys doing this type of work. It takes at least a year of doing the work to get a sense of how your advocacy can affect the outcome of a case. The juvenile system, I think, is a very unique system in that it's integrated with a lot of other systems, with DHS, with the court. So what happens in those systems has a direct bearing on what the attorneys can do. Specifically, what I've seen in the last, I'd say, 3 to 5 years with the severe budget cuts to DHS, there has been a flood of inexperienced caseworkers. And I'm only speaking for Multnomah County because that's my area of practice. Inexperienced caseworkers, inexperienced supervisors, extremely high caseworker turnover. The budget cuts meant DHS couldn't pay for services that they historically had been able to pay for families. And it also meant cuts to service providers in the community. And what that translated into was an even stronger need for real advocacy for families in court on these cases. Attorneys need to be doing independent investigation, not just accepting what the agency is reporting and is saying that they have found. They need to be locating their own service providers. It's not sufficient for the agency to say, we don't have the money, there isn't anyone available. The attorneys also need to be able to look into what is available to assist their clients. And most importantly, I think, especially with the situation with caseworkers, is attorneys more and more frequently are becoming a bridge between their clients and the caseworker. There's been a serious breakdown in communication between clients and caseworkers, and frequently the attorney is the only one who can act as the real go-between. I can't tell you how many times I was probably the only person who had ever spent any meaningful time talking to my client and getting their perspective of what was going on. This coupled with the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which resulted in an increase in court hearings, really put a huge strain on attorneys, I think particularly over the last 5 years. I found myself in trial much more frequently. When I'm in trial, then I have to find coverage for all of my other hearings. I have to prepare for those hearings, and I have to prepare for the trial. In my entire time at Multnomah Defenders, not once did I do trial prep at the office. It was always at home. It was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning or staying up late and working weekends, so I would be prepared to do that type of work that I felt I needed to do for my clients. I loved the work. It was very hard to leave. I'm still conflicted about having left. But the high caseloads were crushing. It became very frustrating because you were in a constant state of triage. You were reactive rather than proactive. I regularly told my clients after a hearing that if I did not hear from them, my assumption was that everything was going well, that they were getting visits, that they were having their children returned, that they were having a good relationship with the caseworker, that they were getting the service referrals that they needed. I explained to them, I have at least 90 clients. Our office had anywhere from, our caseloads range from 90 to 120, 125 clients, depending. And they have one lawyer. And so I put the onus on them, and that's really not acceptable. I should have been able to contact them on a regular basis and check in, especially given a lot of the needs of our clients. And ironically, the longer you do the work, the more painfully aware you become of what you should be doing, what you could be doing, but you cannot be doing. And it becomes increasingly frustrated and disheartening. There is a lot of legal research that I think needs to be done. There needs to be more litigation. It's not getting done, and it's not because the lawyers are lazy. It's not because they're not bright. They don't have time. You're constantly running from hearing to hearing. The high caseloads also result in extremely difficult docketing. I mean, it was not unusual to spend 20 minutes in a hearing setting the next court date. And what that also meant was setting hearings at odd times. You would have hearings at 7 o'clock in the morning, during the noon hour. Later, at the end of the summer, I had a hearing that started at 1 and we ended at 10 p.m. And that's not something that can be sustained long term. And there never seems to be an end. Every budget cycle, every time the contract period came up, there's always a push to take more cases, and there never seems to be a corresponding compensation, whether that goes towards additional support staff or compensating attorneys directly. It's always consistently more work, maybe a marginal amount of increase in pay. There were many years where there wasn't even that, where we were stayed.
Can we wrap this up now?
Yes,
so we'll have time.
That's essentially it. I left because I was burned out and exhausted, and it's really unfortunate because there's a lot of good lawyers out there, and I think they're reaching the same point, and we'll be looking to move on as well.
Thank you, and thank you for coming. I hate to cut you short, but I think between you and Mrs. Sherbo, we definitely have a picture of what's going on out there on the ground. Judge, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Paula Brownhill, and I'm a judge in Clatsop County. And I just want to give you a picture of what it's like for these juvenile dependency cases in a small rural county in Oregon. Juvenile dependency cases are a high priority for my court, and we take them very seriously. They're probably the most important cases that I handle. But we don't have enough attorneys, and we don't pay our attorneys enough. Sometimes we have a lot of people involved in these cases. We've had up to 16 people at council table for a dependency hearing. It takes a lot of attorneys to represent all of those people at the table, and we run out of them in Clatsop County. There are conflicts that occur. There are attorneys who are not available. These cases move very quickly, and so we can't always find someone to be there when we need them. And I think if we pay the attorneys more, we might be able to recruit more attorneys to do this type of work. It is very complicated law, and it requires the attorneys to have special training to do it. We have longer hearings on average than the statewide averages, and we try to meet the standards in the national or guidelines in the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. So our hearings last longer. We have many hearings. We bundle related cases. So an attorney who represents a child in the dependency case may be attending a criminal trial where that child's the victim, but without compensation. Our dependency attorneys attend meetings at DHS, family decision meetings, family team meetings. They visit their clients at home. They attend adoption staffings, committee meetings at DHS. They attend court meetings. We have a dependency team, and I expect the dependency attorneys to participate in that. We have dependency attorneys on our local family law advisory committee. They're not compensated for those, and these are attorneys who have heavy caseloads. So, 2 points I want to end with. We did have the Juvenile Rights Project in Clatsop County for a period of time several years ago. They were representing almost all of our children in dependency cases and providing really excellent, excellent representation, but they couldn't afford to stay. So they pulled out, and we had to find new attorneys for those children. Also, I have tried to recruit attorneys to come to Clatsop County. I went to the University of Oregon Law School and met with a group of attorneys, or law students, third-year law students, who I tried to convince them to open up a practice in Clatsop County, and I haven't been successful with that effort, but I'm going to keep trying. But I think if the pay were higher, we might be more successful. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Cruz, quick.
Thank you, ma'am. No, basically just a comment. I want to thank the panel. A couple points. There may be some aspects of what's going on in Washington we may want to look at as we move forward, not to stop these bills any, but the other point being that there's a double whammy when we don't have enough legal representation. It's also creates an additional burden on caseworkers who sometimes have to become quasi-lawyers, and if we have the appropriate legal representation, then they can just be caseworkers, and it makes the system work better. And thank you for the work, and that was it.
Thank you all for the work you do. It's just, it is quite a mission. Okay, Clyde Psyche and Nikki Cerise.
Oh, here comes trouble.
Yeah, you have about 5 minutes to talk fast.
All they got to say is yes, yes, yes.
We'll be brief. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Psyche. I'm the Deputy Director for Operations for the Department of Human Services. And with me at the table is Mickey Cerise, who is a Deputy Assistant Director for our Children, Adults, and Families Division. I'd like to start by first passing along regrets to the committee from our director, Dr. Bruce Goldberg. He is currently working on some last-minute issues related to the Oregon State Hospital siting process, and if it wasn't for that, he'd be here before the committee. We're here today to testify in support of the concepts in the bills being heard before the committee, 408 through 415. At this time, we're working on several initiatives in the department to help us accomplish our goal of improved child safety, and we feel that the concepts in these bills will be very valuable in helping us to achieve that goal. I just briefly wanted to talk about three of the processes, the first one being the sensitive case review process, of which Representative Krieger has helped us with. He's also shared some information on that process with you earlier in the afternoon, and so I won't go through great detail on it. But I will say that as part of that process, it's always helpful to have some outside people kind of coming in and taking a look at processes and the way things have been handled. And that outside perspective has been a valuable tool in helping us to identify gaps in the system or ways that we can improve on the work that we're doing in child welfare. Secondly, we're in the process of implementing recommendations made by the Wayne Holder Report and the National Child Welfare Resource Center. These are in the areas of policy, consistency of application of policies and procedures, staffing, and training of staff. And then the last thing I'd like to mention is an initiative that we're undertaking throughout the department in the area of process and systems improvement. We want to be an agency that is a continuous learning agency, and as we review cases and situations, want to debrief areas where we can make improvement and identify areas that can be streamlined and made more efficient. I'd like to close just by saying that one of the things Representative Krieger, one of the statements he made earlier in his testimony was about getting it right. And we think that that's key and an important thing, and we appreciate the committee's help in providing us with some tools and support in helping us get it right.
Thank you very much, and thank you for making it brief. We might be able to get some of these bills moving today. Did you have anything to add, Mickey?
Just very briefly, Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm the Deputy Assistant Director for Program and Policy in Children, Adults, and Families with the Department of Human Services. I was part of the group that worked with this block of bills, Senate Bills 408 through 415, and you've heard the collaboration that we went through as a group. What I haven't heard, and I wanted to get on record and mention, this was the first time since I have been with this legislature, and this is my third session, where I have seen all three branches of government come together toward a common goal. And I've heard members outside of this committee mention that this is a very exciting time, and I support that. I think we're on the right track. I think we're moving in the right direction with these bills, and I look forward to an ongoing collaboration. I heard Representative Krieger said there's an intent to move even beyond this session into the interim with this, and we're very supportive of that and behind you all the way. Thank you.
Thank you. And I might just add, it's real, it gives me a lot more confidence to have three of the four work group members participating, two of which are not on this committee, and I really appreciate you attending this discussion. Thank you. I'm going to close the hearing on these bills, Senate Bill 408 through 415. I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 410. Senator Beyer, we have a dash one amendment here.
Madam Chair, I've moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 410.
Senator Beyer has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 410. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 410 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 410 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz will carry Senate Bill 410.
Yay.
Okay, close work session on Senate Bill 410. Open a work session on Senate Bill 415. Senator Beyer, we have a dash one to this one as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz knows the bill. Maybe he should speak to it. I didn't have it out yet.
Okay.
Here it is. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments in the Senate Bill 415.
Senator Beyer has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 415. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 415 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 415 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz, you will carry this as well. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Okay. Holy smokes.
Yeah, you guys.